And I'm Julie.
And this is the A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast. Welcome.
Everybody. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the maiden episode, I guess you'd say.
Right, right. So what are we doing here, Julie?
Well,
What
are we doing? We are a couple of Catholics who love pop culture, movies, books, science fiction, etc. Mm-hmm. But we also love to find the deeper meanings in things, and we don't want to read into it, but we're surprised sometimes at a deeper level of meaning that's in these books that nobody's talking about.
Yeah, and often a Christian meaning.
Yes.
Something that means something to us, you know, as Catholics that we notice. And that in other forums, you know, haven't really brought these things up because it hasn't been the right place to do so.
Yes.
Because we end up in debates on side issues. You know what I mean?
Well,
it's hard, you know, there don't seem to be many religious folk talking about stuff like this. Yet it's what I kind of live in that area. You know, my Catholicness and my fiction loving aren't always something that I find people who share both, you know, and
right.
You are one of those people. So
right.
It's fantastic to be able to talk books with you.
Well, that's the thing. And I think we've both found ourselves in discussions also where it's not that maybe a persecution complex, but it's that most people I think would find who have a deeper faith life, that's not embraced in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The world meaning the office or wherever. And it's surprising how many people you will find who will kind of respond to those key or code words. But a lot of times when you're talking about science fiction or mysteries, the main group of aficionados tend to be very proud of not, I think they would call it being superstitious,
mm-hmm.
or having a deeper Christian or Catholic faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you find those things, it's hard to bring them up because you don't want to alienate them. You want to be able to talk on the same terms, maybe is the right
way
to say it.
Yeah, and you also don't want to get into debates on, you know, whether or not God exists. You know,
right.
It's like, you know, we don't agree way back here, but we're all talking about something that's way up here. And for us to be debating on things is meaningless because we've got to go way, way back. You know what I mean?
Yes, it detracts from the book or movie or whatever you're talking
about.
Not,
you know, it's not the right discussion.
Yes.
Right.
And then, Scott, you'd been thinking about doing a podcast like this for a while, and then I read The Reapers of the Angels, and I was so dying to talk to somebody about the other things I was finding in the book that we thought we would do it in a podcast.
Yes, and it's great. What a great book.
Yes, it's a good one to start with.
It is a really good one to start with. Yeah, and you and I both share a love of Flannery O'Connor.
Yes.
And so, I really want to read this one quote because I think that it kind of sums up, you know, our feeling. So she says, "I believe, too, that there is only one reality, and that is the end of it. But the term Christian realism has become necessary for me, perhaps in a purely academic way, because I find myself in a world where everybody has his compartment, puts you in yours, shuts the door, and departs. One of the awful things about writing when you are a Christian is that for you, the ultimate reality is the incarnation. The present reality is the incarnation, and nobody believes in the incarnation. That is, nobody in your audience. My audience are the people who think God is dead. At least, these are the people I'm conscious of writing for." And that's it.
Gee, that could have saved us all our conversation so far.
That's right.
Said it, and that was 1955, I think.
Oh,
and
wow.
I know it's funny to think of that, but she was living in Georgia in a very small town. Catholics were not a majority, that's for sure. And the fiction world she was writing for didn't have that either. And of course, if you read her stories, you really have to dig deep and know where she's coming from to see a lot of that stuff.
Right.
But
right,
yeah, but that's kind of that compartmentalization.
Yeah, yeah.
Is really present, I think.
Yeah, and I've always felt, you know, I feel the same way with science. You know, science and religion is compatible. Fiction and religion is compatible. I mean, it's all one big thing.
Well, that's very Catholic.
Yeah, well, good. Oh, perfect.
Yes. Well, because it's all true. It's all a search for truth with a capital T. And when you get to a view of that truth, there you're seeing an aspect of God. So if it's all truth and not spin, you shouldn't be afraid of it. And that the church has done sometimes better, sometimes worse, but that's the ideal that we strive for.
Well, good. So, all right. Well, let's start talking about our book.
Okay.
All right. We're talking about The Reapers Are the Angels by Alden Bell. And it is a zombie novel that is surprising to me. It was a surprising zombie novel, and surprising in a wonderful way. I thought it was absolutely terrific. What was your impression?
Oh, I agree. I reviewed the audio for SFF Audio, which is where Scott and I first actually met, so to speak, virtually.
Virtually, yep.
And I was originally interested in it because one of the critics or reviewers of it said that it was like Flannery O'Connor with zombies. And just having discovered Flannery O'Connor, I was determined I was going to, oh, I don't think so. And I don't know if you could say it's really Flannery O'Connor, but certainly there were deeper levels of meaning that were amazing. And also that combined with the fact that this shows a girl traveling through a post-apocalyptic world. Most of the apocalyptic books I read tend to happen at the moment you're reading them. You see, before you meet the characters, the apocalypse happens, and then you see how everybody's trying to deal with it later.
Right.
What happens to society and the people. This is 25 years afterwards. This girl's 15. She knows nothing else. This is her reality.
Yeah.
And the reality is there are zombies everywhere and no central government that seems to be dealing with it. And so she's traveling for different reasons at different times and encountering people and societies.
Right. She's pretty much throughout the entire book, she's always leaving somewhere for a reason and always hopefully trying to find something, you know, wherever she's headed. You know, throughout the entire book. And what was remarkable for me, first of all, the writing was terrific.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but what was remarkable for me was the character of Temple herself. Throughout all of this stuff that she's going through, I mean, she's dealing with zombies, she's never known anything different, yet she's constantly saying things like, hey, you know, the world is it treats you kind if you don't fight against it.
Yes.
You know, all those kinds of things. Throughout the entire book, it's just remarkable how she holds everything together while she's traveling.
I agree. And it's that was one of the quotes I had marked. And also when she says, you got to look at the world that is and try not to get bogged down by what ain't. And the whole way through, there's that deeper level, and the book, in fact, starts off with the fact you realize that the reason she can do that is because she's got this underlying deep, deep faith that God's going to take you where he needs you to be. You might go through bad or good, but it's always according to what God wants you to see. And it's kind of an undirected religion. Really, she's not affiliated with anything, but she has this inner knowledge, and every so often she'll meet other people who, oh, I know what you mean. That's right.
Yes.
And I was just stunned by the first section of the book. To start off like that was amazing. Do you mind if I read it?
Oh, please do. Yeah.
It's
fact,
a couple
I was just
of paragraphs.
Turning to the same spot, so go ahead.
Okay. God is a slick God, Temple knows. She knows because of all the crackerjack miracles still to be seen on this ruined globe. Like those fish all disco-lit in the shallows. That was something, a marvel with no compare that she's been witness to. It was deep night when she saw it, but the moon was so bright it cast hard shadows everywhere on the island. So bright it was almost brighter than daytime because she could see things clearer, as if the sun were criminal to the truth, as if her eyes were eyes of night. She left the lighthouse and went down to the beach to look at the moon, pure and straight, and she stood in the shallows and let her feet sink into the sand as the patter waves tickled her ankles. And that's when she saw it, a school of tiny fish all darting around like marbles in a chalk circle, and they were lit up electric, mostly silver, but some gold and pink, too. They came and danced around her ankles, and she could feel their little electric fish bodies, and it was like she was standing under the moon and in the moon at the same time. And that was something she hadn't seen before. A decade and a half thereabouts, roaming the planet Earth, and she's never seen that before. And you could say the world has gone to black damnation, and you could say the children of Cain are holding sway over the good and the righteous, but here's what Temple knows. She knows that whatever hell the world went to, and whatever evil she's perpetrated her own self, and whatever series of cursed misfortunes brought her down here to this island to be harbored away from the order of mankind, well, all those things are what put her there that night to stand amid the daylight moon and the miracle of the fish, which she wouldn't have got to see otherwise. See, God is a slick God. He makes it so you don't miss out on nothing you're supposed to witness firsthand.
Yeah, wow. See, he had me at hello.
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, that says he communicates so much information in that beautiful piece of writing.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, he's an extraordinary author.
Yeah.
At least this book is extraordinary, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it is extraordinary. And, you know, it reminds me of Pat Conroy.
I've never read him.
Yeah, I really... Pat Conroy's Beach Music is maybe something we could...
Okay.
Do in the future. But the writing is just beautiful. And it conveys so much. You know, when you many, many times in this book I reread paragraphs because not because I didn't understand it, but because I wanted to. You know, I was like, wow, that was really well put.
Yes, and I think listening to it, that language comes across really well.
Mm-hmm.
Because you listen to the rhythm of the words, the narrator was excellent. I can't remember her name, but we can put a link to my review. It has
it. Ty Simmons, I believe.
That's it.
Yeah.
She was wonderful. And then when I was afraid that the book wouldn't hold up when I read it, because I got it from the library, and of course it did.
Yeah. Now, there is a unique feature about this book, and I'm interested, you know, if you have any ideas on why it was done, but there are no quotes in there. When someone does a you know, piece of dialogue, it's just part of the text. There's not a quote, you know, the normal way it's done. What did you think of
that? That's right. I thought it was going to bother me, but it didn't.
Yeah, it didn't bother me at all.
I'm surprised.
It felt different to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what his intent was. I haven't found what his intent was. But it felt different to me, and it felt right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was nothing wrong about it, but it was an interesting way to have written it.
I don't know, maybe because the whole thing is so internal to Temple.
Yeah,
and who
maybe
knows?
So, but yet it's not in first person.
Well, that's right. But so, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So,
but it's always from her point of view. Well, mostly. But that will be in the spoiler section.
You bet. Are we ready to go to the spoiler section?
I guess I just kind of did a little tiny spoiler, didn't I? I'm never so sorry.
No. All right. So, in this podcast, what we hope to do is basically give everyone a summary of the book. And then when we're about to go into it in more detail, we're going to warn you. So if you plan to read this book and you do not want it to be spoiled, and I highly recommend that you do read it because it's terrific.
Oh, yes.
Then stop the podcast right now.
That's right. Save it for later.
All right, they're gone.
Okay. Now that they're gone.
That's right. So, again, you know, I know I mentioned this before, but the main thing for me was the character of Temple, who constantly surprised me.
Yes.
And it was in her attitude. And her attitude, she kept saying things, you know, like, you know, hey, God puts you where you need to be. Or, you know, the world, it treats you kind enough. So, you know, as long as you don't fight against it.
Also, staying alive ain't the problem. The problem is staying right.
Exactly, yeah.
And that thing about not fighting the world, she's the only one who, I can't remember who she's talking to. Oh, it's the son at the Southern Mansion, since we assume people have read this or don't care right now, where she's telling him, well, the zombies can't help it. You know, she's not angry at them.
Yeah, they're just, maybe because, they just do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what she says, yeah.
Yeah, and the father, when she's dealing with the father, she's got a sympathy for him. You know, you poor confused thing, you don't understand why you feel this way.
Right, right. Yeah.
So she's extraordinarily accepting, except when somebody's going to do something that's blatantly wrong, as with the hillbillies.
Right, right. And here's a quote that I'd like to read. Says, yeah, she says, staying alive ain't the hard part. The problem is staying right. What do you mean by that? What I mean is I done some things I don't care to talk about. Little sister, anyone alive's got a collection of those things. Maybe so, but it's one thing to feel there's a few rotten things knocking around inside you like some beans in a can. But it's another thing to feel like those things are what your heart and stomach and brain are built out of. Yeah, so she's always thinking about that. And it's never really explicitly explained where she's, you know, what the source of that feeling is, you know. But go ahead.
It must be that old man who takes her and her brother in. And I can't remember his name. I guess I should have written some of those down. But that's the only place she was civilized from, really. Unless it's just that she's one of those people, almost like a prophet, because her name is Temple. And the names matter in this book, at least for a few people, because the man pursuing her is named Moses. So there's Temple and Moses. And I, in addition to Temple's extraordinary internalization of this truth that God's there and you have to keep yourself right and you can't really judge the world because that's not there for you to judge. It is what it is. You've got Moses Todd, who's set in opposition to her, literally, and but yet he understands her better than anyone on earth.
Yeah.
And I found that relationship also to be fascinating in that he understood her so well, but he was still determined to kill her.
Yeah.
Because this was following the rules.
Yeah, every single time that those two were together, it was riveting.
You know, yes,
because it was almost, you know, Moses was just saying, you know, hey, I'm gonna have to kill you, but yet there was a respect there, and they understood each other completely, and it was a complete acceptance of what was happening. You know, it was like they both understood that these are the rules,
and yet the rule that he was following, he was not able to take the world for what it was.
Right. Yeah,
because
that's true.
Because he was willing to cheat the system in order to keep find her using that GPS system, which I have to say was one of the things. There were a few things in the book where I was like, what? You mean it took them this long to reveal this? I knew this from the beginning, practically, about the GPS thing and the tracker in the car. But he was willing to do that kind of thing instead of, oh, God's going to take you where you need to go, because I guess he felt that was his mission, so it was accepted. And then also the fact that he knew what his brother was like. He knew his brother had probably brought his death upon himself. She told him it was accidental, and he was so rigid, he couldn't let it go.
Yeah. So what do you make of that? Is that just some people are cling to the rules without understanding the meaning behind the rules?
Yeah, I guess if you're going to use a standard, you know, Christian term to look at it, you'd look at him as being almost Pharisaical, if that's the way you say that word. Like a, you know, you get most of what's going on, but you can't figure out how to apply it to every part of your life. Because at the end of the book, he does have a greater understanding. He knows that Mari is his to take care of. He finishes Temple's quest to Niagara Falls for her. And I have to say that that image of those wild horses running over the hills in Ohio is one of the most beautiful pieces of the book. That image has haunted me. So So Alden Bell, if you're listening, thank you. I just love to imagine those horses pounding over the hill. But I don't know. I just looked, maybe, I don't know if you can read too much into the names, because Temple and Moses are unusual. Temple's always on the move, doing what God wants, as far as she can tell. She may have a misunderstanding of what she's done in the past, because Moses helps her see that you're not evil. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just sad.
Right, right.
And sorrowful for what happened. And everybody makes mistakes. Mm-hmm. She can't accept it. But he then makes a very similar mistake when he brings that little girl with him, whose one goal to Temple was to kill her. I don't know if that answers anything, but I just
but
looked at that.
You know, I don't know. I think the best books, you know, just make you think about these things. You know, one of the reasons that Temple is so fascinating to me is because I think that that is exactly how you get around in the world we're in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everything is worth fighting against. And that's how you stay stable, I guess.
Well, and also even the point where they're getting ready to inject Mari with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she suddenly feels in the back of her brain, oh, no, don't make me do it. Don't make me do it. It's like it's a separate entity. So you don't know if this is a response of God, if this is just her and she can observe it that way.
Uh-huh.
But when she just starts taking everybody out, I was put in mind of River in Serenity.
Yeah,
at the end, which is a different deal altogether. But
yeah.
Where it's like she's God's, I don't know, equalizer?
Yeah, God's instrument.
Yeah, God's instrument. Mm-hmm. And I was...
But, you know, the conflict between what's moral and what's right, you know, so that's one of those really difficult places where you're, okay, well, no matter which decision I make here, there's going to be some wrong,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that was her conflict inside. She was, she knew that whatever happened, she was coming out with a scar.
Well, and she was holding too much against herself, because when you find out what really happens, you realize that it was a natural human mistake. She's not evil.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody makes mistakes, and everybody has things where they blame themselves too much, and she wouldn't turn it over to God.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she makes that confession to that woman and is able to get it out, suddenly she's a little easier with everything.
Yeah.
Or we are.
Right. We certainly are.
Yeah.
But... you know, I think she is too. At that point in the book, I think she is too.
Yeah, I think so. And so that was kind of an interesting look at, you're right, it's kind of a personification of the moral life that we strive for, and being able to find what is it that God wants you to do, and the way you fight against it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I know what I need to do, but whoa, really?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Right.
I don't want to, you know, speak up, stand up. I just don't want to go do this thing, even if it's, I'll just go visit my mother-in-law once a week.
Right.
To speak of a recent conflict I had with within myself.
Uh-huh.
Love my mother-in-law. It's not her. It's, oh, wait, this isn't my time to portion out. I'll use this in this way.
Right.
Which is far from fighting zombies.
Yeah. And, you know, and what's with the fascination with zombies, do you think? I think for me, it's not so much the zombie as it's the society ending, the civilization ending,
mm-hmm.
and needing to rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is my fascination with zombies, not so much the actual zombie.
Right.
Although it's a constant threat and it's always out there, but I think it's the destruction of civilization that it represents that interests me most, because I love a good zombie story.
Yeah, but I love a good apocalyptic novel, too.
Yeah,
The Stand.
And as I do, too. Yeah, The Stand is one of my favorites.
Yeah, Lucifer's Hammer.
Yeah.
Those kind of books are... And I used to, when I was younger, you know, and I'd go, okay, say I had 15 minutes, I had to get everything together, what would I take? Or what if the world was going to end? What are the five things I'd want to have with me? And that's kind of that desert island scenario in a way. But it's just... I guess it's that fascination of looking at the end of the world, because I just finished rereading World War Z.
Oh, that's one I need to read.
Oh, and that's really kind of, I believe the consensus is that's the book that kind of launched the zombie being able to be taken from horror movies into other things.
Oh.
You know, Max Brooks wrote The Zombie Survival Guide, which was amusing, but a lot of people who've read it, and I haven't, have said, oh, you could really use this for a lot of survival needs.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you didn't have to worry about zombies. But then he went on and later wrote World War Z, which is, for anybody who doesn't know, is the basically it's the aftermath of the zombie uprising
mm-hmm.
through a virus. And it's a report that was done for the UN for facts and figures so that they could look at how to help prevent it from happening again or something like it. And at the very beginning, we're told, well, I included all these first-person narratives because it's depth to the history and the numbers. And they said, we don't need that. And he complained, and they said, well, you're free to write a book. So that's the book. And it traces it from patient zero in China to the end.
Wow.
And it's an excellent book. It doesn't have that deeper meaning from the point of view that we would be looking for on this podcast, which is, you know, faith or what else does it teach us about how to live. But it does have a number of comments about our society, especially about America and the way we live, our government. It's just a very interesting book and really well written.
Okay.
But that's the one that most people say, that's when people went, oh, this can be extended. And so you have things like Shaun of the Dead movie,
mm-hmm.
Zombieland, and this book, in which people are using that, the apocalypse, in a broader sense to say, what else are we looking at?
Yeah.
You know,
those books that we've mentioned so far, almost all of them have the transition between normal world to chaos, right? And this book is all chaos. But it's interesting that Temple, you know, like you said, had never seen the world as normal. So, you know, there were points throughout the book where she was like, you know, what was it like? You know, where she considers, you know, buildings and things that must that have been like. And but
where she says, oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say some of the most poignant pieces are where she says, well, she's had older women tell her about what life was. And she says, I don't really think it was possible to just ride your bike down the street. I think there had to be more to it than that. But, you know, sometimes there wasn't, just like for her.
And that reminds me of the point in the book where she gets to a town that's walled so that, you know, inside the town, everybody's free to walk around. And this boy wants to go on a date with her. And she's just like, is there going to be ice?
That's her main luxury.
She wants, yeah.
Have a Coke with ice.
Coke with ice, yeah.
So. Well, and it's kind of interesting because when we see the different societies, we're basically seeing a commune, some hunters, the southern elite, which is a throwback to talk about denial. It's just this household that's completely isolated and thinks things will go back to the way they were, those religious fanatics. And then that town again, which is a broader extension really of the southern mansion. And it shows that their grip on reality is also tenuous because the boy is like, well, we're going to take back the country and let's go on a date. And a date to him, he doesn't even know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know?
Right.
And that's kind of more typical of an apocalypse novel in terms of you see the different ways mankind is rebuilding. But here you get to see that people are still 25 years later clinging to this idea that it's not the world as it is. But she still doesn't even judge them.
No, she doesn't. No, she just thinks it's kind of funny.
Yeah, she's like, well, that's weird. And, you know, I guess they'll be okay. Yeah. She doesn't worry about them. She just goes on.
Yeah, she gets Coke with ice, so she's good.
Yeah, it's the luxury. Oh, and those guys on the train, which I found to be the most interesting and practical of the entire group.
Yes, yep. That was fascinating. Yeah,
that was,
Have you seen The Walking Dead?
No, I don't have cable.
Okay. Yeah, I watched it online. I don't have cable either. I watched it on iTunes.
Ah, there you go.
But
I'm
that
cheap,
is very excellent. So it deals with some of the same issues that are here, but it's also got the deep moral issues that come with the apocalypse. You know, the zombie apocalypse creates a lot of problems morally, right?
Right. But, well, that's and I guess that's it. What those stories do is bring them to the fore in a way that you have to write about differently if you're writing about society in general.
Yeah, yeah. And what happens to all this stuff that we consider important? And we value things that don't need to be valued. And when all that stuff is ripped away, what it does to the people that are value those things is as interesting as the people who are able to survive, using, the correct attitudes, or, mm-hmm. I say correct, but the, right. the attitudes that are put upon you because it's the only way you can get by.
Yeah, and it was an interesting look at people not only looking at the past, but twisting what happened to make it fit in their idea of how things should be, like the hillbilly community, you call them. Mm-hmm. That was the religious fanatic community.
Yeah.
And I think maybe what Temple shows us more than anything is how desirable it is to be in balance. I mean, it's okay to want a Coke with ice. It's okay to enjoy a pretty sundress and maybe think that, oh, I would have liked to stay in those places I went to. That's not a bad thing. And what I come across so much is people who are all one way or all the other. And this is what drives me insane. People who are, you don't think about this. And when you're looking from the outside in, and I'm a convert to Catholicism, mm-hmm. from a completely secular upbringing. So that's kind of where I come from mm-hmm. in this aspect. But they're like, oh no, I'm throwing away my TV. No Halloween for anyone. I don't think we should tell Santa Claus stories to anybody because that's just lying. And that's almost a fundamentalist attitude that the church certainly doesn't endorse.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to people who are just floating on the surface of doing, the Catholic thing. They never look any deeper. They never look into themselves as much as they might. Like, I don't want to sound judgmental because everybody's doing the best they can, really.
Sure, sure.
Which is kind of what this book shows also.
Well, you told me once there is no such thing as an ideal Catholic.
Yeah.
And that helped me quite a bit.
Oh, well, good. Well, it's not a...
Because from that.
Right. Well, and like I say, I go back and forth between those two. And so maybe that's why it frustrates me, because I will, at one time, I'll be defending the most basic things. And the other time, I'm going to be going, stop telling me Harry Potter books are evil. Okay? Period.
Right, right.
But, and then at other times, I'm going to be saying things like... I'm trying to think what I would say to the other side. Oh, just stop taking what society says about the church and look for yourself mm-hmm. a little deeper.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't know why we got there from here. I guess that's because that's what I was thinking about. All these different societies they were either clinging too much to the law and the way things should be, or making for themselves something without stopping to think about what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the religious fanatics.
Right.
They were interpreting things way past what they should have.
Yeah, and I think, since this is our first podcast, this is the point of the podcast. Because one thing that you and I have noticed is that when we read books like this, we think about things like that.
Yes.
It has to do with the church, because the church is part of our reality.
Yeah.
And it's not for everybody.
Well, and the Christian life is part of our reality.
Sure.
And
it is, yeah.
So even on a level where, I mean, even in our day-to-day life, and the author may be laughing at me now on this point, but even on a day-to-day life, we're almost like Temple going through those little islands of life, to where I see the FedEx lady, and she and I had a conversation one time just out of the blue where we know each other as good Christians,
mm-hmm.
or my hairdresser and I, and we're not both Catholic,
uh-huh.
but we're both on that same quest. Even in just regular her delivering packages every day, and so making sure she smiles at everyone no matter what,
yeah.
or me trying to always do the right thing in our little business.
Uh-huh.
You know, trying to be honorable even when it's not maybe the most advantageous. So, and like you say, that's, I'm never with that. Well, of course, you can't live every minute thinking about that. Mm-hmm. But that's always underneath everything.
Yeah, and it sure is. For me as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to get to before we wrap up is,
yes,
I found a page on Macmillan.com, and I'll throw a link to it on the blog, that's written by Alvin Bell, called The Books Behind The Reapers Are the Angels.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he just kind of lists some things. It's a really cool one-page deal, and he lists some things that he said contributed to this book. And one of them was The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner.
Okay.
A book that I haven't read.
Me either.
Uh-huh. He said there's some small homages to Faulkner in Reapers, and one of them is Temple's name.
Okay.
Which comes from Sanctuary, and that must have been a novel. And the figure of Mari, who is based upon Benji in The Sound and the Fury.
Okay.
And then it says also the Grierson episode evokes the short story A Rose for Emily about a woman who refuses to make the transition from past to present.
That's interesting. I haven't read either of those. And it's, we didn't talk about Mari at all, but maybe because he's kind of a mystery in himself. He doesn't talk. He's not. He's just barely sentient enough to maybe, you know, put his hands in his pockets.
He wasn't as strong a character as, you know, of Mice and Men as what that always reminds me of. But
yeah, Lenny.
Yeah, Lenny. But he wasn't as strong a character as Lenny. He was always there, but he was never the center of attention, really.
No, he was just kind of a responsibility that everybody took on. And
that's exactly,
I did like
what it was,
the fact that, for me, the thing he pointed out is that life was precious. Everybody was willing to, you know, everybody was interested in him just because he was a person. He didn't have to contribute anything.
Yep, that's really so true. Yep.
And I found that to be very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Me too. The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is another one he lists.
He says
Reapers is structured as a classic American road novel, the form of which has its roots in Huck Finn.
Mm-hmm.
It is episodic. We're drawn forward by an overdetermination of motives, an escape from whatever imprisonment is behind, and a pursuit of whatever freedom lies before.
Wow.
And also he says Sarah Mary Williams comes from that. Huck Finn.
Oh.
Huck Finn used that name when he dressed up as a girl.
Oh. Well, see, I'm just not that
smart. I love it.
Yeah, that is great.
It is
that
really
is great.
I just love that.
And
stuff.
She is a tomboy.
Yeah.
She's much more like a boy than a girl. And she's awkward when she's dressed up as a girl.
Uh-huh.
Because of how she's had to live. That's great.
All right, and then Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. Another one I have not read.
No.
He calls this one of the great American books of the second half of the 20th century.
Wow.
Let's see. Its storyline makes it more of a Western, but its style is pure Southern Gothic. The primary conflict is between an unnamed kid and a man who seems to echo the expansive chatty kid, or chatty evil, of a Faustian devil. I think my character Moses is a kinder, gentler version of that antagonist.
Yeah.
And then, so that's cool. And then the last, it's two more. Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston.
Hurston.
You wouldn't normally associate Hurston's lovely, poetic, romantic novel with zombies, but she does tap into a folkloric kind of mysticism that has always fascinated me. My term for zombies, meat skins, actually comes from Hurston, but she uses it simply to describe puny human beings. Meat skins dancing around the toes of time.
Hmm.
And
now both the kids have read that, but not me.
Okay. And then, I guess he mentions two here. Winter's Bone by Daniel Woodrell and Smonk by Tom Franklin.
Okay. I'd like to see the movie Winter's Bone. I didn't know it came from a book.
Huh. Okay. These are two masters of the contemporary Southern Gothic genre. My character of Temple is inspired by the tough, relentless heroines of these two novels.
Wow.
So both of these authors create teenage girls who have managed to survive in brutal surroundings, who have actually grown accustomed to violence and corruption.
Okay.
Yeah. goes on to say, but what both these authors admire about their characters, you can feel it in the affectionate way they write about them, is their ability to maintain a certain purity within their own individual codes. Interesting.
Wow, and he achieved that so well.
He sure did. He sure did. It was striking.
Yes, which is why it's so upsetting when Temple dies at the end. Gigantic, huge main spoiler.
Dear Mr. Bell, why?
You upset me greatly. But the thing I think I was saying before is, or maybe I can't remember now, is I was so fascinated by the fact that, well, for one thing, Moses is so annoyed that he kills the little girl that she was mine to kill.
Yeah.
Because I guess to him it had to have a purpose, which I was like, okay, do you see how stupid you are? And I guess we can't. We get mired down in things like that and we can't step outside and see it. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that he takes Marianne.
Yeah, yeah.
And fulfills her desire to see Niagara Falls in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've got to tell you, even though it was upsetting, felt it was very satisfying.
It was right, and as I was mentioning to you before we started, I felt he scored 5 stars on my Joss Whedon meter, which is my standard for a person who will not hesitate to kill off a beloved character if it's right for the story.
It's right for the story, right. And that's funny. The very last item on this page, he says, and it would be remiss of me not to mention 2 television shows that contributed a great deal to Reapers. The first one is Deadwood. And the second one is Buffy.
Okay.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
So okay.
He is familiar with Joss.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because I really hate Sarah Michelle Gellar, so I could never get past that to watch Buffy. But
I was a big fan. I liked it.
Well, and I've heard that if I just kind of persevere, she gets less the character gets less whiny, so it's easier to kind of not worry about it. But I really liked Angel, and of course Firefly to me is wonderful, and this would almost put me in mind of Firefly in some ways.
Yeah.
Not exactly, but it's the road story, the searching for the truth, the keeping to your standards even when it hurts you as much as you can, kind of thing.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, and then the last thing I wanted to mention is also on the same page. There's a little 5-minute audio that Alden Bell, I actually found it just this morning, and he just talks about the book. And at the very end of his quick little talk, he says that he said the novel is a call for an appreciation of wonder in a chaotic world.
That is good.
Yeah, I think so too.
Because then one of the things that we were also both, I think, thinking is we don't want to read into it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you can't help things to just, when you start off with that passage I read, you can't help but go, there's a God theme underneath everything.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And he doesn't mention that, but there's definitely that feeling of wonder and appreciation for the world, the people in it. And that's about as based in truth, capital T truth, as you can find. It is a wondrous place we live in, and we forget to look up and see it. And that's the whole book is that full of people that are like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the items that I recall that brought me back to the church was this sense of wonder. And I think as adults we often lose that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was in a Umberto Eco novel, Foucault's Pendulum. I don't even know if I'm saying that word right.
Yeah, I haven't read anything by him, so okay. I don't.
But I just recall, this struck me, must have struck me at exactly the right moment. But there was a scene in that book where this guy went and he was watching this pendulum. And it was in a big museum somewhere. And this giant pendulum, swinging back and forth, and how when the earth turned, it would adjust so slightly, and it would, you could tell the time by how this pendulum was going, and how it was attached, you could imagine it being attached, in an infinite distance above, And then in comes this couple, one person with his face in a textbook, and the other one, his girlfriend, who's... just saying all kinds of off-the-wall things about this pendulum. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know, as they walked away, all he could think was, there, you know, there he goes. His mind is blunted by that textbook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's totally lost his sense of wonder. And I think that hit me at just the right time, where I was like, you know, that's so true. And it's part of the whole Christian viewpoint, is that it is wondrous. And
yes.
That's not to be ignored. It's to be embraced and to appreciate.
Yes. And the fact that I'm... the thing that amazes me is you look around at, let's say, the world we live in, which Temple was obviously in love with, and it's so different from anything we would ever have thought of, ever.
Right.
I'm just always amazed by all the variations of life and interaction and, you know, even, I guess you'd say, the ecology and everything, that I just look at that and go, wow, I could never match that. We can do great things, and that's fine. Like, you know, write wonderful books and make wonderful pieces of art. But these are things that are just outside of the way human beings think. And that's, I guess, I embrace the natural world in a lot of kind of regaining that wonder, which is what Temple is doing on her road trip a lot, wanting to see Niagara Falls and the fish and the wondrous places in the world. And like you say, that's part of, it's the Christian, underlying the Christian experience, but it's definitely underlying the Catholic experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you will find certain groups, I think, that don't necessarily always ascribe to this, but the Catholics always start off going, God made the world, and then everything he makes, he's like, oh, and that's good, and that's good, and that's good. And I was kind of trying to remember that. Doesn't mean I want the wasps next to my back door, but...
That's right. And no snakes.
Yes, but it does make them easier to watch. So,
for certain. My extra thing this week is I'm going to go ahead and recommend The Walking Dead. We're talking about a zombie novel, and I know I mentioned it earlier, but it truly is excellent. Deals with some of the same themes as this novel. Deals with it in a really excellent way. Again, it's very Stand-like, you know, the Stand by Stephen King-like. In fact, the whole show reminded me of something that Stephen King could have done in the tone and how rich the characters are and the stuff that they're forced to go through. Anyway, it's very well worth watching.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And how about you?
I've heard a lot about that, and you're like the 50th person to recommend it, but not from that particular point of view, which interests me much more. What a surprise. my extra thing is completely frivolous, since I already brought up World War Z if we were going to do zombie related, but I'm going to do something completely different, which is Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And that is, it has a meaning that's very good, but you don't have to dig very deep. They make it pretty obvious. But anybody who likes Edgar Wright's movies, which would include Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and the TV show Spaced, which he and Nick Frost and Simon Pegg did together for, I think, a couple of seasons in England before his movies, will enjoy it. If you like video games, you'll enjoy it. And it's a story of, I guess you'd say, early 20s love, but don't let that turn you off. This movie has a lot more to it than that, and it's just thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah, I remember just the opening with that 16-bit video game Universal globe spinning. I was like, oh, this is going to be something I'm going to like.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that altogether, but yes, that tells you where you're going with this. That was my extra thing. And then next we're going to try and alternate books and movies.
Mm-hmm.
So you chose the movie,
yes,
since I chose the book.
And I chose Serenity, which is kind of cool because we spent a little bit of time talking about that today. So
yes.
So we're going to have some of the same themes there.
Yeah.
Serenity, looking forward to talking about that.
Yes. And then at the blog, we'll try and keep in the sidebar the coming attractions, which are things we're planning on doing in the future, so that if anybody does want to read the book beforehand and listen to the spoilers when we do them, it will be there.
You bet.
So,
and that's A Good Story is Hard to Find, blogspot.com. And that's probably a good end right there.
I think so. Thanks to anybody who's listening, and we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
All right. Thank you.